Hi, volleyball fans, and welcome back to Volley Talk, the podcast created for volleyball lovers who want to dig deep into what is going on in NCAA and international volleyball. I'm your host, Sarah Pavin. I'm an Olympian, beach volleyball world champion, former Nebraska Cornhusker, and longtime pro, both indoor and on the beach.
And I'm Adam Schultz, former indoor player, international volleyball coach, and the show's resident stat guy.
We had a bit of a slow week this week. PVF was wrapping up their regular season play, and quite frankly, the games didn't really mean anything because the top four were decided on Sunday. So
they were nothing games.
Yeah. And in addition to that, the NCAA men were preparing for their championship tournament that is happening this coming weekend. So I would probably say the biggest excitement was coming from Istanbul with the Women's Champions League Final Four, but that's just my opinion.
Which also turned out to be somewhat disappointing, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. But with the PVF and NCAA men having their season-ending tournaments coming up, we are going to go through a bit of a preview of each of those to kind of go through what we're expecting, what we're looking forward to from those events. So we're really excited to dive in. So let's get started. The NCAA volleyball transfer portal opened again last weekend, and it will be open for about a month. I've been getting a lot of messages from people about this, first of all, so thank you to everybody who keeps me in the know, you know what I mean? But I also went through the spreadsheet of what they have going on and picked out some of the notable transfers that have decided to enter the portal. So to start off, from Michigan, Valentina Vallette is leaving. She was a starter for them, their ace leader. I understand Michigan isn't like a Big Ten contender usually, but she played a big role for them, so she's leaving. And freshman middle blocker Logan Wiley is leaving Georgia Tech.
I was really curious what was going to happen with Georgia Tech as a program in general, just given we watched some of the coaching interactions.
Have actually like three or four players that have entered now.
Well, no, and I know that that had happened, and I was curious, were we going to see all of the fallout all at once? Was it going to happen slowly? I think that seemed like from the outside, it seemed like a volatile situation last season. So no, I'm not surprised about this at all.
Logan Wiley was definitely like the standout of the people on the list because she was a starter. So interesting stuff there. Now we're coming up to the three biggest shocks for me. First of all, Kennedy Martin is leaving Florida.
I am both... I'm both surprised and not surprised at the same time with this one.
Here's the thing.
So I don't know any of the juice.
Word on the street is, and I got to thank my sources for this. Word on the street is that her NIL agent is trying to get her $1 million to go somewhere.
He better be damn sure that he can get her that, because you enter the portal. I'm sorry, as a coach, if somebody enters the portal, you can't take that player back.
Well, and I get like Mary Wise retired. She was probably a huge draw and a huge reason that Kennedy Martin went to Florida. I get it. But $1 million? Come on. There's only a handful of players making that professionally in the world. Like, you guys know how I feel about the NIL money being thrown around. But like,
other than slightly jealous.
A little. Like, Tori Stafford didn't take near that amount, okay? I'm sorry.
I mean, she, next to Olivia Babcock, might be the best pure point scorer in the NCAA right now.
Adam, $1 million. Like, you're a child. You're, like, what, 20 years old? It just sets you up to fail professionally, in my opinion, because it's like you're making that in college, like, the percentage of athletes, good athletes, that make that professionally is so small. There's a very select group. And it's like, you're not... Are you going to peak in college?
A lot of people will. I hope along with her NIL agent, she's got a very good financial planner.
Well, if that happens for her, I am going to be on the floor over here. No. Anyway, that's what she's asking for. We'll see if she gets it. I will be shocked if she does, but that's just me. Lola Schumacher is leaving Wisconsin.
You had to think that one of the liberos was going to leave.
Gushchikin already left in January. That's the confusing thing.
Oh, I forgot about that. That was not on the
top. Yeah, Miley Chan is like the one that's left. So Gushchikin left because Schumacher took her libero spot as a freshman. She had the spot locked down, but this is another source that told me. Apparently, Schumacher was told, yeah, you're not going to play this year, so you're better off just leaving. Who do you have coming in? Because, like, I saw Wisconsin play a lot this year, and I also saw them play when Gushchikin and Schumacher were both out with injury or concussion. Didn't look great.
Well, they definitely needed to shore up their ball control. Like, that was a real issue. They better have somebody hiding in the weeds somewhere that is going to... That's tough. You lose both liberos, and it was a position of weakness for you last year.
Well, not to mention, apparently you told her to leave.
Yeah. Well, all of that stuff you got to take with a grain of salt, I think. But
well, I'm just telling you what my sources reveal. You know what I mean? Well,
I don't have any sources, so.
Well, here's the last one. Mariana Singletary is leaving Texas. The middle blocker. She was only a sophomore, I think. Like, when they got her going, she was very good.
This one I'm confused about because Texas has money. They're a good program. She was good with them last year.
Well, Texas dished out the money to Tori Stafford.
So I'm curious, like, you have to think that, and this is the problem with paying players in college, right? When nobody's making any money, you guys are all in the trenches together, sweating, bleeding, working towards something.
Crying at times.
When you now have salaries with players who come in who you think you're better than and all of that, like the team dynamics just shift. If she wanted something and got nothing, is that a reason to give the program a screw you, I'm going somewhere else? Like that, these are the interesting team dynamics that come up when these salaries start getting out. And when your teammates start showing up in very expensive cars to school and things like that, it's
and like we're not saying that it is a money-related decision for her leaving. We understand that there are lots of reasons that athletes decide to enter the transfer portal, but this one for me was the last three for me. Well, again, Mary Wise leaving. Okay, fine. Yeah, I'm confused by this one as well.
Well, we'll see where they all end up.
If anybody has the juice, you know where to find me. But, yeah, we'll see what comes up as the weeks progress here because I wasn't expecting this at this point. So the overseas leagues are wrapping up. So we just wanted to highlight a couple of the results from those leagues based on where our listeners are tuning in from. So in Brazil, Osasco won the Superliga for women. The men's match is actually happening as we record, but Osasco beat Sesi Bauru 3-1 in the final, and actually former Nebraska player Callie Schwarzenbach plays on that team, so a little bit of an NCAA connection there. Orecho won the Toron Liga, the women's league in Poland. They beat Woods, who we talked about for some Champions League matches, 3-0.
That's a tough look when you qualify for Champions League and then...
Well, Russia actually made it to the same level as them, but they got absolutely hammered by Conegliano.
And that's fair. I mean, the Coneg is a very good team, but to lose 3-0 in that is maybe a little surprising because I thought Lodz was decent when we watched them.
Oh, yeah, they were good. They were good for sure. The men's league is still finishing up. So we'll see what happens there. Zenit Kazan won the Russian men's league, and Kaliningrad won the women's league. Kazan is a powerhouse. I'm not shocked that they won, but I'm actually surprised that Kaliningrad won. I expected Kazan to win that one too, but that happened. And Osaka Marvelous won the Japanese women's league. Men's league is still happening. There's a pattern here, everybody. Okay.
Does the women's champions or international season start before the men's? Is that why the women's teams wrap up?
I want to say for VNL, they alternate weeks. So it's like women, men. And then on the off week, they like travel and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I do think the women go first.
Got it.
Which is why they're like a week ahead in their leagues. But if you've been following the Italian league, Civitanova and Trento are tied 1-1 in that final. Match 3 is actually happening as we're recording this.
We watched that match. What were your... Give me your highlighted thoughts.
Trento did not look good. I expected them to look way better.
Well, they got smashed.
Smashed. They got aced so many times by one guy.
It was...
And Moni Nikolov's brother actually plays for Civitanova, which was interesting to watch him play.
Yeah, it was a very lopsided game. I was not expecting that. I was expecting Trento to have something going on, but it was... it was not a fun game to watch. It was a lot of errors, very one-sided.
I think I fell asleep, actually.
Yeah, you might have. they both have won now. We'll see what happens with the third match, but I was pretty disappointed in the caliber of the match itself.
Civitanova's on one. They stormed back against Perugia, so they're definitely on a roll here. But, like, Trento has... the consistency throughout the season. I think their right side played really well. I think their one middle played well. Their libero struggled, in my opinion.
Oh, horribly.
So hopefully they will get it together when they go back to Trento, where they are right now. But definitely tune into those matches if you're interested in that. And finally, the Champions League Final Four for women has been happening again. The final is happening as we record this, but in the semis, Conegliano beat Milano in 4, and probably the shock to viewers everywhere was Scandicci absolutely demolished Vakıf Bank 3-0.
Okay, so let's talk about these a little bit. We'll give a brief highlight for those people who are interested and maybe didn't get a chance to watch. Conegliano has beat Milano 16 times in a row, I believe,
is the current record. 16th time, yes.
And I haven't watched all 16, but... We've watched maybe five of them. This was the closest Milano has come to beating them, and quite frankly, I think they threw away a couple opportunities. Milano started incredibly well. They got leads... Conegliano was a little sluggish at the beginning. Milano managed to find leads in almost all of the sets that we watched.
Maybe all of them except one.
Yeah. And I think the disappointing thing, without going into too much detail, is I thought most of the team played incredibly well, minus Iguanu.
She was real bad.
She needed to be okay for them, and I think they win that match given the current state of things.
Yeah. They were pretty close, and she was awful. I don't think I've seen her play that poorly this season.
She was set 42 times in those 4 sets. She had 13 kills. She had 7 errors and 4 blocks, or she was blocked 4 times. She didn't get the blocks.
She almost hit 0.
I'm sorry. I believe she was the highest paid player on the court. And yeah. She wasn't very good in the finals of the Italian league where these two teams played
as
well.
She just looked disengaged.
I totally agree. Tipping balls that she needed to swing on. And, you know, we talked about the setting in one of the final matches that, you know, maybe people weren't in rhythm, but she started well. Like
she was very good early. I think she scored four of their first six points.
Correct. So I looked at her and I watched the beginning of that set and I thought, okay, she's grooving today. We're going to have a game. And it just went downhill for her real quick, and I did not think the setting was an issue. I thought their left sides played well. I thought the Naze played well. They had a really good team strategy going. They put them in some trouble. They were tipping the Hogley. All of the adjustments.
Their defensive adjustment was way better. Like, yeah. Their defensive positioning was so much better than in the final. It was so disappointing because it's like, I understand that she's had a heavy load all season and she has been the one that's expected to score, but I'm sorry, that A comes with your position and B comes with how much you're making. Okay? Like, sorry. Yeah, you're the show. Be it.
Yeah, if I'm the Milano front office, I'm pretty disappointed at this point because we shelled out for a point scorer and all of your teammates showed up and you couldn't even be decent. And I think the thing that bothered me the most was she looked disengaged. Like, she started fired up when she was playing well, and then when things didn't go well.
And when they made a comeback in set four, she showed, like, was into it again.
Yeah. The things that you can control, you need to be engaged with your team. You're not going to have an all-world match all the time, but the attitude when things weren't going well for her and kind of the disengagement, like, that's, you're in a Final Four. You had a chance to win against a team that pretty much never loses.
Well, she has such a good history in the Champions League, too. Yeah. Like, this could have been her sixth final in a row. Like, that's an incredible, you know, career so far. Five Champions League finals in a row. And she just, yeah, it wasn't good. But I thought Cazot showed up.
Played really well.
Played really well. I thought Dalderop, like, held her own. The middles, they ran the middles more, specifically Danese, and yeah, she was very good. I was confused why Miriam Silla was on the bench. We talked about that in the final, because, like, when she came on, she brought the energy that they needed, and she was passing decently, she was scoring. Like, I was just really confused about the decision to start her on the bench, and, like, she barely played.
Yeah, and she did a good job when she came in. I'm thinking maybe ball control. Like, if Agani was scoring some points, then the other left sides were decent. But I think they needed, that was the one thing. I think they needed to put her in earlier when Agani was struggling to score points, because Scylla's got, she's a little bit more wild, but she's got a heavier arm. Like, she puts defenses in a little more trouble than the other left sides do. But,
and Conegliano wasn't bad, but they weren't, I think their setter struggled.
I thought their setter struggled. Hawk struggled from the service line. Like, she didn't generate as much pressure as she did in other matches. I thought Zhu Ting started slowly. Like, there was some passing trouble at the beginning. I feel
like that's a pattern with her. She kind of, like, takes a while to warm up into the match, and then she's incredible.
Yeah, but she cost them early, like, unsettable balls out of system stuff from her early, which...
And Gabi was not being put in good positions to score. Like, too far off the net, too tight, like... She was getting blocked and making errors, but honestly, watching, I'm like, these balls are not in a position. Like, they just looked a bit out of rhythm.
Yeah, I agree. Now, the thing for Conegliano, and if it wasn't for their libero in those matches, she...
Incredible.
She covered and extended some plays to... Like, they were down by 4 or 5 points, and it could have easily been 6 or 7 if she didn't make some spectacular covers, some great digs. And let me tell you, most importantly, and you're going to smile when I say this, her out-of-system setting to Hawk.
Amen.
Conegliano got out of trouble by their libero putting Hawk in a position to score when there were 3 blocks, and Hawk delivered. And... that kept the margin close enough in a few sets,
she
honestly.
Was outstanding.
Where they could, their other players could kind of come in and find some rhythm. And without her, they don't win that match, in my opinion.
Coming off of a week where we just talked about how coverage isn't as prominent in the women's game for liberos, she proved me wrong. This Moki Dajanara was all over the place. Like, so good. And if you're a club coach, I cannot stress to you enough the importance of having your liberos be consistent setters. Train it. Train it all day. Like, obviously, they're going to learn to pass and play defense, but train that setting because, man, I can't say enough good things about liberos who can set.
It was, you know, I think everybody expected Conegliano to win this match, but Milano made it interesting and had a shot to win. I enjoyed watching this one.
The game that I did not enjoy watching so much was Vakıf Bank and Scandici. Going into this, I was so certain that Vakıf Bank was going to absolutely crush Scandici, and it was opposite day. The complete opposite happened. If I had bet on this match, I would have lost so much money. That's how convinced I was that Vakıf Bank was going to roll through this.
Let me toss out the set scores just for a little bit of perspective here, okay? Scandici won 3 straight, 25-12. That should never happen. That's in awful. A Final Four, anything. That should never happen in Champions League, right? 25-12, 25-19, 25-21. It was awful.
It was, to be fair, Scandici showed up. It was a full team performance.
Absolutely.
Everybody on the court, you could tell, wanted that match. They were engaged. They were dialed in. The game plan was tight. Like, everybody for Scandici played well. And honestly, nobody could get going for Vakıf Bank. Absolutely no one.
It was, I don't think I've seen such a team, like a complete team meltdown.
It just, they looked like they just didn't even know what to do. They were so exasperated. They were just like, what do we do now?
Yeah, it was wild. Now, Hrbats and Antropova
for Scandici.
Yeah, were untouchable, all world. Hrbats was set 20 times and had 11 kills on one error.
And honestly, it seemed like she got set so much more because of how efficient she was and her energy.
Completely. And Antropova, her numbers weren't amazing. So she was set 31 times. She had 15 kills, so she scored a lot of points. She had 5 errors and 3 blocks. But for me, the thing was, anytime that Vakıf Bank kind of generated any momentum, she was able to score and put an end to that. And Scandici didn't make a ton of mistakes as a team. Like, other than that, 7 total attacking errors, 5 of them from Antropova.
Whoa.
But
I mean, she's the opposite. It's
right. Yeah. So Scandici was very clean as a team, and they needed somebody to take some risks, and she showed up, and mm-hmm. she served incredibly well as well, put them under pressure. Those two were fantastic.
So the difference for me in watching, it was Vakıf Bank could not get Scandici out of system. They were not putting enough service pressure on them, so Scandici could do whatever they wanted. And Scandici also completely dismantled Vakıf Bank's serve receive. Vakıf Bank was setting every ball from like 20 feet off the net. Their passing just completely fell apart. And that's the difference, ladies and gentlemen. If you're a kid who plays volleyball, serve and pass. It might be boring, but serve and pass all day, every day. It'll help you win.
I loved how they kind of zigzagged the seams. So the Vakıf Bank libero, I thought, struggled.
Yeah.
And they would go from 5 into one seam, cutting over one shoulder. Then they would switch. They would go to the other side, force her into another seam. And it looked like her responsibility was to pass both seams, which is fair. Like, lots of liberos do that. But they attacked those seams. There were a couple times where players were looking at each other. I thought the game plan that Scandici had coming in was incredibly well thought out and very well executed from a team perspective.
100%. And Markova, for the first half, I would say, completely struggled. Got served off the court.
Yeah.
Like, saw her just, like, swing at a ball to pass and miss it.
Correct.
Like, could not score. Kira Van Rijk is their other point scorer. Could not find the court. Like, when your 2 point scorers just are nowhere to be found, plus your serve receive is that bad, like, it's not a recipe for success.
Well, Van Rijk hit negative. She had 12 sets before she got pulled off. She had 4 kills, 4 errors, and was blocked once. And Markova was set 29 times. She had 10 kills, but she had 5 errors and 1 block. Or was blocked one time. So just not particularly efficient. And they didn't pass well enough to run the middle, and just nothing.
It just really highlighted what a difference good serve receive can do for you.
Yeah.
And good serving. Because it was just, I felt bad for them almost, you know?
You got to show up and you got to be ready to play. And they did not execute.
Honestly, if Scandici plays the way they did against Backup Bank, they could push Conegliano. Again, I could probably check the score right now, but Conegliano, when they're all playing well, are virtually untouchable. But Scandici was pretty flawless.
Yeah,
it'll be hard to replicate that performance. But
well, Scandici's never made a Champions League final, so that was final a four. Huge,
even this was their first one.
Yeah, so making the finals, that's a huge win for them. Well, I'm curious to see, can they replicate that performance? I think for them, they have to make Conegliano match and beat them. I think Conegliano has more high-end talent. They're better overall.
Their budget is just off the charts.
But, I mean, good for Scandici. You had an opportunity. You came in. You were the underdog, and you stuck it to him. All right, so if we look to the NCAA men's tournament, the finals will be this coming week, but we saw the play-in match for the 7 seed, which in and of itself is a head-scratcher.
I don't know, man.
That happened over this weekend, and we saw Penn State beat Damon 3-0. I don't think that's surprising.
Is it? Like, Penn State...
I understand that Penn State, you know, we have...
I've got it out for Penn State this season.
We've ripped them throughout the year, and rightly so. They've been terrible. But they righted the ship, you know, towards the end of the season, and... they're just a more storied program than Damon. They have better athletes. They see better competition. They're more prepared. I can't say I'm surprised with this result.
Overall, overseas is where it was at this week. A little slower as the leagues finish up and we start to head into VNL season, but some exciting volleyball nonetheless. So if you want to find it anywhere, YouTube, CEV, Eurovolley TV, Volleyball World TV, lots of great options, but I mean, it's always a good week when there's some volleyball.
All right, so we are heading into PVF Championship Weekend. So given the fact there was not a lot going on this week that was meaningful, what we thought we would do was we would break down the semifinal matches, make some predictions, and talk about the showdowns and the teams going into the Final Four this weekend. I'm not sure what I'll have to say that. The championship weekend. I think Final Four is copyrighted.
Probably.
Or trademarked. So we have Omaha and Indy playing in one semi. And we have Atlanta and Orlando playing in the other semi.
This is based on like what we have heard the tiebreak procedure is. Because Omaha and Atlanta actually do play today. And if Atlanta wins, both teams will have the same number of wins. And so from our understanding, it then goes to that point thing that they haven't used and we've been confused about, which Omaha has a steady lead in that.
So if we're wrong and this doesn't happen and these aren't the matchups, just disregard.
But from everything that I have been led to believe, if there is a tie in total season wins, it goes to the points. So I'm assuming, like, regardless, Omaha's going to finish first.
So that definitely makes logical sense.
It makes logical sense, but we have been surprised before.
Okay, so let's look at the team stats from a high level, and then we can drill down to some of the players and positions. So the season record between Omaha and Indy is tilted in Omaha's favor. So Omaha won the first two meetings 3-0, 3-0. They won the third meeting 3-2, so it was a little closer. But Indy won the last meeting 3-0. So
a little bit of a swing as the seasons progress.
Yeah. So I think that is interesting. You know, if you lose all four matches to one team, you know, you don't really have a great mentality or mindset going in. But having won the last one and having played them tighter in the one before that, this is definitely a match that I think Indy believes they can win.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Now, if we look at the statistics across the teams are very close. So kill percentage is 36.3% for Omaha and 36.7% for Indy. So
oh, wow.
Pretty much exactly the same. And actually, the stats across the board for the teams are very close on the season whole. So kill efficiency, Omaha has a slight lead. They're 24.3 versus 22 for Indy, but within a reasonable margin there. And then everything else is pretty close. So Omaha is 0.77 aces per set. Indy's at 0.84. So they have a slight serving edge, which I think is going to be important in this matchup. The blocks are 2.64 for Omaha, 2.5 for Indy.
Wow.
So, yeah, again, super close. And then, again, digs per set, Omaha is 16.64 and Indy is 16.53.
This is actually crazy how close these teams are.
Yeah, the teams are very, very similar statistically. So this is going to be, you know, and with a one-off playoff, which is something we've talked about, you know.
Not our favorite.
Anything can happen. Who's going to get hot? Which players are you going to look at? So I was thinking, let's kind of just talk quickly. Let's compare the setters. Let's compare the liberos. Let's see where we think there'll be some edges and kind of go from there. So from a setting standpoint, where are you at?
I think everybody knows my feelings on Sydney Hilly throughout the season, but I think she's leading the league. You know, she's big, so she's not a liability at the net. She's, like I said, leading the league in assists per set, I think, or just total assists. She has become more consistent as the season has gone on, and we talked about that with Indy early, as they would always play the set one, set two really well, and then just, like, disappear. But clearly they've, like, cleaned that up a bit. So I'm giving the setter heavyweight to Indy.
I agree with that. I think that Valentina Anderson. She's consistent. She works hard. She's
experienced.
Fiery. Yeah. I think the only, you know, we've talked about Sydney Hilly fading down the stretch, and she has done a good job of negating that, but does it happen under pressure in moments, you know, down the stretch?
Well, I would say that question could kind of be opposed to the teams in general, because like Omaha won the whole thing last year. Indy's the expansion team. They haven't been here before. Granted, Omaha has some young players on their roster who weren't necessarily a part of that team, but they have a couple that returned, but like Indy, they all are new to that program. So yeah.
I think that'll be something to watch. I think that Sydney Hilly definitely has the potential to outset Anderson in this match. What are your thoughts about the libero position?
We know Adam's thoughts. His favorite libero of all time, Elena Scott, plays for Indy. Honestly, I think Elena Scott's better.
Okay, so we've given the setting and the libero edge to Indy. And I think that that's probably accurate in my opinion. I agree. But what about the middle position?
I don't know. I think the middle battle is kind of balanced. I think the Indy middles are very strong blockers, but they kind of fade off in the offensive side. Omaha's middles are also very good blockers, and I think they're more offensive, but from what I've seen, they don't run them enough. So it's kind of a moot point if they're not going to set them.
I think this game is going to be won or lost in the middle. I agree with you. I think all four of them are very good blockers. And so whoever can hold the middle of the court, now you can do it by running the middle or by running the pipe over top, but whoever can make life difficult for the other team's middles, I think is going to get an edge in this series. And that's passing and decision-making and the middle's ability to be available. I think that's something that is going to be key in this matchup. And now we'll talk about the outside hitter cores. So, and this is where I think things get interesting. Which group of outside hitters do you like better? And so let's, real quick, we have Brooke Nunneveller, who's probably been the league standout in this one. So she's going to play a key role. Reagan Cooper, we're looking at Emily Londot. They have Allie Batenhorst. How would you compare that to Nina Chayich, to Azani Teeler, to Anna DeBeer? I mean, obviously, they're missing Lector Member Mena, which is tough for them. But
But I think Azani Taylor has really elevated her performance since Member Mena went down.
She's the wild card to me.
She has come on very strong in the last half of the season. Honestly, as a core, I prefer Indy's core. But Nunaviller has held things down for Omaha all season. There have been a lot of inconsistencies with the second outside position, with the right side position for Omaha. But, like, she has shown up consistently night after night. So I think as a group, there's, like, less pressure on one individual for Indy. But I do think that Brooke Nunaviller is capable of carrying the load because she has proven it if her teammates aren't having a great night.
I think Taylor is going to have to be very good for them to win. And she's definitely capable, but does she show up in this specific match? Because she's going to have to score a ton of their points. You know, I like Anna DeBeer. She's consistent. She's not going to kill you in the match, but I don't think she's going to win you the match. Nina is very good, but I don't think she's super terminal. She scores points, but she's not getting balls at a system and swinging to score. Like, Taylor's going to have to do that, in my opinion.
So who do you think is going to win?
I think Indy's going to win.
You heard it here first, everybody.
I think they have the momentum. I think they're kind of the underdogs. I think there's a lot of uncertainty around Omaha.
What do you mean?
We don't need to get into that here. My one caveat to that will be if Brooke can single-handedly win the match. And that's a definite possibility, having watched her play this season. So if Indy can make life difficult for Brooke, I think they have a very good shot at winning.
I think if they can get Omaha out of system and just camp out on Nunaviller on the block, I think she'll have trouble scoring.
All right, so let's move on to the Atlanta-Orlando match, which I think is pretty interesting. If we look at the season history, so Orlando won the first meeting of the season 3-0. Orlando won the second meeting of the season 3-2. But then Atlanta won the last two, 3-1 and 3-0. So Orlando started well. Atlanta finished strong.
Which we've seen.
Yeah. And if we look at the team statistics, again, they're incredibly close over the course of the season. So kill percentage as a team for Atlanta is 36.4. It's 36.6 for Orlando. Kill efficiency is 23.7 for Atlanta, 24.8 for Orlando. They're 1.16 aces per set for Atlanta compared to 1.13 for Orlando. Blocks is 2.28 versus 2.15. And Atlanta has a slight advantage in digs per set at 17.3 versus 16.7. But marginally close across all of the stats across the season. So again, this should be a very close and competitive game.
I mean, we've seen Orlando kind of take a dip. We've spoken about individual players, about the team in general. Like, they started off so strong and have kind of petered out a little bit. They righted the ship a little bit towards the very end, but I think the trajectories these two teams have taken throughout the season are kind of opposite.
I would agree with that. Okay, so let's kind of go through the same thing. Who wins the setting battle in this one for you?
I'm not going to lie, I'm not a huge fan of either setter. I think it's a wash, honestly.
Okay, so you're rolling the dice on that one?
Yeah.
What about from a libero standpoint? Or let's say, so libero versus who do you think is the better passing team?
Well, I think Morgan Hentz wins the libero battle.
Okay.
I think Atlanta definitely has the stronger libero. Passing-wise, the outsides for both teams are medium for me passing, but I would give the edge to Atlanta.
Okay. Now, I think I agree with your assessment on all of those. I think you see inconsistency. This match for me overall is about which players rise to the occasion. I think you have players who have been good and bad throughout the season, and it's kind of a question mark as to what happens. Now, we'll get to there with the outside core.
Mind you, when we talk about passing, we do have your girl, Natalie Foster, on Orlando, who disrupts a lot of serve-receive systems. So there is that to take into account.
She was going to be my wild card. Well, so for me, Orlando has two wild cards. If Natalie Foster goes off and has a game, and Abercrombie has a game, and both of those to me are relatively large question marks, but if those two players have really good matches, this team is going to be tough to beat.
Well, I think Abercrombie is stronger than Beeson on the right side, but I do think that the Atlanta outsides are better than the Orlando ones.
Well, and Orlando has been inconsistent as to who can find their game at any given time. I mean, you have potential, but you kind of never know what you're going to get with the outside. Are they going to be all world or are they going to hit negative? Yeah. And for Orlando, I think, and this is a big if their top players who they decide to start play relatively close to their capacity, I think Orlando is a better team. Their ceiling is higher, but they don't all hit that peak at the same time very often.
I think even if we look at the middles, I think Atlanta with like Corey Lewis, I think Atlanta is stronger in the majority of positions aside from like setting, as I said, was a wash and right side. Again, I am going to take the opposite stance. Like if both teams are playing to their potential, I think Atlanta wins.
So I like that we have a little bit of a different view on which team has higher potential. Who are the, if you're looking at one or two players from each team, who needs to have a good match for them to win? Like, who are you watching to see if they show up?
For Orlando, Abercrombie. When she struggles, the whole team, like, is real bad. So she needs to put points on the board. I think one of the two left sides, any of them. And I would honestly say Shaftmaster, too. If she is engaged and she is getting her feet to the ball and she is being smart with when she chooses to go on two, that's a good thing. We'll see if it happens.
And for Atlanta?
For Atlanta, I think if they can get Corey Lewis going, that's huge. I think Leah Edmond, both from the service line and offensively, is an X factor. And I mean, Hence is always consistent, so I don't feel the need. I think, honestly, those two. I think if those two are solid, I'll say Hence just for a ball control perspective. But if Edmond and Lewis can get going, then I think other players can be medium and it'll be okay.
Who do you think is going to win?
Atlanta.
Me too.
You were just saying Orlando.
I know. I think
Orlando. You don't think they're going to fulfill their potential?
Yeah, I think Orlando has the ability to win, but I just haven't seen all of the pieces. I mean, Shaftmaster, big question mark as to who you're going to get. Abercrombie took a huge dip, started playing a little bit better. Where is she going to be at? You know, again, you have the left sides need to show up and play well. You have no idea. There's just, they have the potential to win, and when they're all playing well, they're a very good team, but we just haven't seen that consistently enough with, and then you add the pressure of a one-off match. I think Atlanta has been more consistent more often.
So if you want to find out, be sure to tune in. The championship is happening May 9th and 11th. That is Friday and Sunday. So the semis are happening Friday on CBS. So let's see. The NCAA Men's Championship is happening this week as well. They are going down Thursday through Monday in Columbus, Ohio. As we mentioned earlier, Penn State beat Damon for the play-in match. So we've got 8 teams remaining.
I'm so excited to watch this.
I'm excited.
Well, the second round.
But let me, what are your thoughts on Long Beach State taking the 1 seed?
Ludicrous.
Okay, right?
I'm sorry. You go, Hawaii won.
Hawaii won the conference and beat you 2 out of 3 times you played.
I get that Long Beach has been very good. I get that they have a very good record, but no, I think
I don't care.
I think I'm agreeing with you.
I know. Okay, I'm just breathe. Like, I'm expressing my frustration at the whole situation. This is just ludicrous.
But see, the thing that doesn't make sense for me is Hawaii slotted at 2, but then they get the play-in match, which generally should technically go to the 1 seed. I think it's mostly irrelevant. Other than, I mean, Hawaii has to play UCLA versus playing Loyola or Pepperdine, but it just doesn't make any sense
to me. It's like, okay, Long Beach State's out of conference schedule, I have talked about this at length, was not strong.
It was soft.
So soft. If you are incapable of winning your conference, you should not get a top seed. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't.
No.
I don't agree with that. I don't think it matters in the long run, but yeah, it's a bit head scratching when I saw the rankings come out.
And not to mention, it's like, oh, hey, all these teams qualified. We are just going to decide that Four Valley State is the worst team in the tournament. So we're going to do the play-in match for the 7th seed. It's like, what? What? Like, at that point, just make Fort Valley State play Damon or something. You know what I mean? Like, the play-in match should play the 1 seed, and the 1 seed should not be Long Beach State.
Well, and I mean, given how Penn State started the season, I don't hate that they were in the play-in match. I mean,
fine.
But yes, I understand. I understand your point.
None of this makes sense to me.
No.
At all. It's just a joke.
Now, is there any, I don't know, splitting conferences or TV schedule or any reason to do it this way that you can see?
Well, I honestly, what I would have done is put Hawaii as the 1 seed. UCLA didn't even win their conference. I just if you don't win your conference, you shouldn't be a top 2 seed. But the way they've set it up is so it's like a Big West final. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know. I understand we've got 2 teams from the MPSF. I think how it would have gone down in women's is the 2 MPSF teams would have been on the same side of the bracket and the 2 Big West teams would have been on the same side of the bracket just to keep interest across conferences.
Well, I definitely think the final should be Long Beach State, Hawaii.
So, I think they are the 2 best teams, but like you don't see this layout, and I understand it's like a fraction of the number of teams in women's, but still.
And the strength of conferences is, you know, different than
and
all
like
of that.
Pepperdine beats UCLA and then wins the MPSF and then they're the 5 seed.
I think Hawaii, and again you got to play all of the good matches, but Hawaii should have gotten the winner of Pepperdine, Loyola, Chicago in the semi. Like that should have been the path for them. I still think they're going to beat UCLA in the semi. We can talk about that in a second, but I think it's going to be a Hawaii Long Beach final.
I would agree. I think the final will end up being Long Beach State and Hawaii. I think the semis we're going to see, like you said, Hawaii versus UCLA, Long Beach State versus Pepperdine. I think the best quarterfinal match is going to be Pepperdine versus Loyola Chicago.
I agree.
Which I also think is interesting. Because Loyola Chicago, their star is Parker Van Buren on the right side. Pepperdine, Ryan Barnett has stepped up massively. So we've got like, I wonder if they're going to match them up like in the front row with each other, or if they're going to try to like let them just like run free, not against each other.
This is actually the only interesting quarterfinal match to me. I think the other ones are all going to be blowouts, but I'm not sure that Pepperdine wins this one. You have a bigger team who has played very well. I guess the thing for me is, can Pepperdine keep playing the way they've been playing? So they were very good in their conference finals, but they were at home. They were comfortable. You know, they had Hartke didn't play amazing, but their left side stepped up and kind of, I don't want to say came out of nowhere, but had a really good conference final. Can you keep that mojo going on the road after you've won? I think Loyola Chicago is a very technically sound team. I think they're going to have a very good game plan. I think they're going to be ready to play. Pepperdine is bigger and more physical, but Loyola is skilled and I think gritty.
It'll be an interesting matchup.
Yeah. I think Pepperdine is going to have to come in and win that match. If they're not playing well, I think Loyola Chicago can win that match. So this one, I'm very curious to see. I to me, this is a pick 'em. I think this is a 50-50 result wise in terms of who wins this one.
Well, that's the last match on Thursday. The games go all day Thursday, and that's the last one. So they're saving the best for last, I think.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing that one. I think that Long Beach will beat either of those teams. I think they're just better. The Hawaii-UCLA semi is interesting.
It's interesting, but I think if everybody shows up on Hawaii, if everybody shows up for both teams, I think Hawaii's better.
I agree. I'm concerned that UCLA is inconsistent. Their top players, you know, we've watched them quite a bit this year. Sometimes they show up, sometimes they're motivated, sometimes they look a little lethargic. They're young, kind of inexperienced. I'm curious how they deal with the pressure.
But on the flip side, Hawaii is different when they're playing at home.
This is my concern for them. How do they travel? Do they have the same energy and intensity without? And we've been told all over this week how well Hawaii fans travel. I'm looking forward to seeing it in the stands. But again, it's not the same as being at home. And we've seen them drop a couple matches on the road that they have no business losing to. I'm curious, and I'm curious to see if Tetriski is back. Is he healthy? Right. Can he play?
But even if he's not, Carney has played well.
But you miss the presence of Tetriski there.
And the security blanket.
Yeah. I'm curious to watch that semifinal. I think Hawaii's going to win, but I'm curious to see the little storylines within that match. And I think that there's potentially a lot of question marks in that one. So the quarterfinal between Pepperdine and Loyola Chicago is a match I want to watch. The semi between Hawaii and UCLA I want to watch. And then I think the final is going to be spectacular.
Like, none of this happened, and it's just like a complete mix up in the semis, and we're like, yeah, so excited for this match. And then surprise, not even going to happen. These are our predictions.
You never know. But
so if you had to say right now, who's NCAA champion?
Long Beach.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's really hard to beat a team multiple times in a row. I think the neutral site for the final plays into Long Beach's favor, not Hawaii's.
Oh, I've been obsessed with Hawaii all season, so I'm just going to ride this to the end. I'm just going to say Hawaii.
I love watching them play. I really like their team. I'm secretly rooting for them, I think. But I think that Long Beach is going to come for blood in the final.
One last thing that I do think is worth mentioning that we didn't talk about in the weekly highlights, but I want to touch on it because I think it's important, is GCU cut their men's volleyball program.
Heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking. It just is so disturbing because the sport is growing. This was a team that was a Final Four team last year. They were top 15 in the country this year. Like, they are consistently showing up and putting out great seasons. And men's volleyball is growing. So many more boys are playing volleyball now. And there's such limited opportunities to play post-secondary that to take one of the top programs away is just absolutely devastating to the sport. So there is a petition going around. Check it out on social media. Who knows if they'll make a change, but I think it's important for decision makers to understand how important boys and men's volleyball is in the country. Again, word on the street is GCU switched conferences to the Mountain West to be able to bring football into their sport lineup. So that is where the very limited men's volleyball scholarships probably went.
Yeah, it's really sad to see because you hate, again, a program with history who has been good just is non-existent anymore, potentially. So hopefully that changes. I'd like to see a Stanford situation in this case.
Bring it back. Yes, totally. And my heart goes out to the players. Like, where are they going to go? And then the recruits that committed. Yeah. Like, now they have to pivot. Like, I'm also like, do you think the coach knew that this was in the works and that's why he left and went to Kansas? Or do you think this was completely out of left field?
I would like to think that the athletic department would give their staff a heads up about this so they don't leave them high and dry.
So you think he knew and just peaced out?
Yeah, I think so.
That makes it even worse. I hope that's not the case. People are fighting for GCU. We need to be aware of, like, things like this, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. But on a positive note, we got a celebration of some good volleyball happening this weekend on the men's side, so be sure to tune in. It is time for our weekly questions, and since we're heading into the PVF championship this weekend, I think number one is appropriate. In who do you think is the best rookie in the PVF?
I have two selections, and admittedly, I'm biased.
Let me guess, Natalie Foster.
And Elena Scott. So I, you know, again, everybody's going to have their opinion. Everybody has their favorite players. I think that Elena Scott, you know, came in and earned a spot. She wasn't given it. You know, she came in and I thought she played really well at the beginning when she had opportunities, and then took over the spot and really was able to help her team make the Final Four. I think she passes well. I like the energy she brings. There's a stability to that team. And in general, I just like the way she plays. So I would pick her for one. And then I think Natalie Foster has had a really good season. I think she's unique in her serving capability. I think she can be, you know, a wild card. I believe she was very close to leading, if not on top of the league, for service aces and aces per set. I think she grew as a middle in terms of how she played. I thought she got better from an offensive standpoint. I know there's lots of options. Those are kind of the two X factors for me that I liked following this season.
I might be completely off the wall here, and this might surprise people, but I'm going to pick Corey Lewis.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I think she stepped in to a team that was projected to win the league. So obviously they had the pieces there, but she stepped in as a rookie, starting incredibly important from an offensive perspective. She didn't have any back row experience because of all the subs available in college, so developed her serving game, had to develop a bit of a defensive game, you know, her blocking. I think the product that she has put on the court and the improvement we've seen and how much her team needs her, she's my pick.
Fair enough.
Who would you guys put on your list? No, it's not a list. It's one player or two if you're Adam.
Well, liberos and middles, they kind of make one position.
Exactly. They play the whole game between the two of them. Okay, question two. If athletes play so soon from season to season, so this could be going from NCAA to Lover PVF, this could be going from pro to playing VNL, how do they have time to recover?
So this is...
They don't.
Well, it's a great question. I think one that you are actually particularly suited to answer, given your experience in history. The thing I will say is, it's not really about the amount that you play. It's about the little things that you do day to day to stay healthy. Are you disciplined with doing a proper warm-up? If you have injuries, and everybody does, do you manage those on a daily basis? Band work for your shoulders or for your hips, or getting physio or icing? Are you consistent in the gym, or when you're off, are you off? Like, it's about doing the little things. And again, outside of acute injuries, which happen, but from a longevity standpoint, the technology, it's about habits of staying healthy. And you see athletes who can play for a long time, and the national team athletes go from pro to national team to pro to national team with very little break. It's definitely possible if you're disciplined.
I would say the hardest transition that we see today is probably the girls who go from NCAA directly to pro, because in NCAA, there's not as much time available to do the full recovery stuff because you're going to class, you're doing your homework, you're studying for exams. Like, there's a lot of extra stuff that is required of you from a student perspective, whereas when you're a professional, like, it's your job to be healthy. And, like, when you're not at practice, there's a ton of time to then prepare to be able to be good at practice the next day. And also, if you have a good coaching staff, like, they understand load management and stuff, and they're not going to just, like, beat you to a pulp every day. Like, there definitely are some ebbs and flows about how hard you go in training sometimes versus, like, easing off a bit. So from a professional perspective, it is easier. All right, question three. This person had a question about jump serving. So after watching several Love and PVF matches, I've seen several topspin serves that were pretty slow. In your experience, do you think a slow topspin serve is the easiest serve to return overall? This person refers to, like, Babcock and Micah Hancock as having very good spin serves, and they do. But if you're not hitting it as hard as them, is it more predictable and easier to pass?
I would say 100%.
100%.
As a passer, if you give me a nice trajectory spin serve that doesn't really move or is not coming with a ton of pace, it's just easy to follow and pass. I would much rather pass a spin serve than a good float serve.
My ranking of serve difficulty to pass from easy to hard is, like, standing float serve, because you can't really put much on it, jump topspin serve, jump float serve.
Yeah, and again, you have degrees of difficulty, but if you're looking at people who are the best at those types of serves, I agree with you.
I would say if you are not putting side spin on your spin serve, jump topspin, or hitting the piss out of the ball, there's no point in doing it.
Yeah.
Like, you need to hit it with a ton of pace, and you need to make it move. If you just hit it straight, even if you hit it hard, it's so easy to control. So the best spin servers, and if you watch the match from the end of the court, you can often see this, particularly in the men's game. The most successful spin servers are hitting the ball very hard, and they put side spin on it so it moves out of the passer's window. But I would say if you're not doing that, you're better off jump flow serving.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay, our last question of the week is, can you define the specific hitter positions and how they're different from each other? When or why is a player labeled as a left or right side hitter? What does opposite hitter mean? Like, opposite to what? And is pin hitter just a general term? So this person is asking, are some specific positions and other are just general descriptors? Because you do hear on broadcasts a lot all of these terms kind of mixed together. So I can understand why this can be a little confusing.
Yeah, this is kind of a great volleyball 101 yes. question if you haven't grown up playing the sport. Okay, so opposite refers to playing opposite the setter. So in volleyball, a lot of the terms have to do with where are you relative to the setter. So when you hear, you know, rotation 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's where the setter is currently. And so when you hear someone say opposite, they play opposite the setter. So on the right side of the court, if you're standing at the baseline. So opposite and right side denote somebody who hits on the right side of the court.
Same position.
Same position. Outside hitter refers to hitting on the left side of the court, so position 4, and your left side players are generally, not always, but generally your passing players. So they pass on service reception, and they hit on the left side and out of the pipe in the front and back row. When you hear somebody refer to pin hitters, this generally refers to the core of the outside hitters, both your left sides and your right sides, and they say pin hitter because they hit out by the antenna, which is also referred to as the pin.
So we've got some synonyms for the same positions. We've got, there's a lot of terminology, but I think that was a good breakdown.
We love these kind of questions. So if you
don't feel ashamed to ask these.
I can't tell you, I watch some different Netflix shows in terms of the sport ones, F1, golf. I don't do anything in those sports. I hear things. I've got buddies who are big fans. I'm always texting, what does this mean? Was that important? You know, what about the tires? I don't know anything about that. Yeah, but it's, again, it's specific and it's important if you're in the sport. So if you hear something on a broadcast, please shoot us a question. We're happy to answer them.
So hopefully that helped a little bit. But thank you to everybody who submits questions. We love them, so keep them coming.
All right. So bit of a slow week, but we managed to make this episode just as long as the other ones.
We can't help ourselves.
And this coming week is going to be a banger for volleyball. We've got some of the men's finals internationally that you can watch. So most importantly, we have all of the championships coming up this week. So it's going to be a great week of volleyball. PVF semifinals start May 9th at 8 p.m. Eastern. And the finals are May 11th at 4 p.m. Eastern. All of those are on CBS Sports, so tune into those. We'll see who ends up in the final, and those should be very good matches. So we also have the men's NCAA championship tournament happening this week. So quarterfinals start on May 8th at 11 a.m. on Eastern. Semis are May 10th, starting at 5 p.m. Eastern. And the finals are May 12th. At 7 p.m. Eastern. Quarters and semis you can find on ESPN Plus, and the finals will be on ESPN2.
So because the finals for NCAA men are Monday night, we're not sure of this yet, but I feel like next week's episode could be, or will likely focus on the PVF side of things, and then the next week after the men's final has finished, we'll probably address that then. So just to set your expectations, we're trying to figure out how to make it work because it's two big events happening this weekend, but you'll find out. That concludes this week's episode of Volley Talk. There's always something shaking in the volleyball world, and we hope you enjoyed this little fix. Be sure to follow the show so you don't miss any updates, and we'd be so grateful if you'd leave us a 5-star review. You can also find us on Instagram at volleytalk_podcast. If you have a topic that you'd like us to discuss, be sure to let us know by reaching out to us on Instagram or at info@sarahpavin.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll be back next week.